Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is Stuart Patrick, who is a senior fellow at the Council of Foreign Relations and director of the Program on International Institutions and Global Governance. His new book is Weak Links, Fragile States, Global Threats, and International Security. Stuart, welcome back to Berkeley.
It's great to be here. Thank you, Harry.
What was your goal in writing this book?
Well, when I was I used to work at the State Department during the first term of the Bush administration, and when I was on the policy planning staff, one of the assumptions that we had taken on board after 9/11 was that some of the most pressing challenges to U.S. and to international security were increasingly emanating from weak and failing states, with Afghanistan obviously being uppermost in our mind. And when I got out of the administration, I thought to myself, I wonder if that's really true. And so I set about looking to see what evidence was out there about that proposition. And it turned out there really wasn't much that had been written about it. So my book was an effort to really try to probe a little bit more deeply and comprehensively into that analytical question.
And how long did it take you to write the book?
You know, it took me about 5 years because I was working on other projects at the same time. It had its origins really in an article that I did for the Washington Quarterly back in about 2006 that was Weak States and Global Threats, Fact or Fiction. And what I wanted to do was think a little bit more deeply about what we really meant by weak and failing states or fragile states, and then to look at what connection they had with several of the most pressing transnational security threats on the global agenda that they were often associated with. And that required me to delve into five different topics that required me to become a little bit of a specialist in each of those. So it took quite some time.
Now, given what you just described, your training is academic. So you come to this work with a PhD, I guess, in political science, right?
It's in international relations, and it was a DPhil because it was from Oxford, but yes, a doctorate.
Okay, but then you're sort of in the policy world,
right?
So this is an important interface here. That is, what does academic quality research? How does that feed in to the policy process, which in the period you were in the government was often driven by ideology?
You know, very much so. I got to the Bush administration during the first term as an international affairs fellow of the Council on Foreign Relations, which is now my current employer. But those fellowships allow you to go from the world of ideas to the world of working for a living, and in my case, but also in the reverse as well. It was actually one of the things that struck me most about being in the Bush administration was the degree to which ideology appeared to be driving so much of American foreign policy, and also the degree to which there was almost a willful ignorance of some of the lessons that had been learned during the 1990s. I came to the State Department having been at New York University, where I'd been working for about 5 years on the problems of post-conflict reconstruction. And so many of the things, for instance, that we found out about how difficult it is to stabilize stabilize Iraq were things that in principle had been learned by academics and analysts, but were just willfully ignored when the administration actually went into Iraq and to some degree in Afghanistan as well.
And is that a product of the electoral process? That is, okay, we'll do everything the opposite of
right.
What the people who we defeated did when they were in office. So is it that, or is it more ideological? Namely, we have a view of the world, and this is how it is, and this is how we will act.
You know, I think it's a combination of the two in this case. You know, there was a saying when the Bush administration came in that it was ABC, anything but Clinton. And so anything that the Clinton administration had done in foreign policy or national security terms was seen as somewhat suspect. And as you recall, during the 1990s, when the United States was getting involved in a lot of weak and failing states and around the world, whether it was Somalia or in Bosnia and the former Yugoslavia, it got a lot of criticism from those on the right for engaging in foreign policy as social work. Mm-hmm. And so the administration came in, I think, with a default position that, you know, we don't do nation building. What was interesting, though, was that during the 1990s, there had been a criticism, particularly by many on the right, that why was the Clinton administration wasting its time with these sort of third-tier national security concerns in the developing world? What happened, though, after 9/11 was really a crucial pivot, which was encapsulated in George W. Bush's statement in 2002 in the National Security Strategy, which is the United States is now more threatened by weak and failing states than we are by conquering ones. And this led to a wholesale reorientation of U.S. foreign policy and a sort of a grudging acceptance and movement towards the notion that, well, actually state building and nation building and post-conflict reconstruction is something we're going to have to get involved in. But it was a lukewarm embrace, I would say.
Now, this raises an interesting question, which is, with the fall of the Soviet Union, America lost its grand strategy of containment. And there was a period in the Clinton administration where there was a search, you know, for what would replace it and so on. Is it your sense that this focus on fragile, failing states became was a handle for a substitute strategy? Namely, it told us that there were a lot of places, maybe too many, that we had to intervene in?
Yeah, I think it led to a real strategic reorientation. I think during the 1990s, there was a lot of sort of feeling around about what a successor strategy to containment could be. The Clinton administration at first came up with the notion of a strategy of engagement and enlargement of the world's market democracies. I think the George W. Bush administration came in with a little bit more of sort of a hardline but relatively traditional conservatism. What really changed was the attacks of 9/11, because they fundamentally altered the paradigm. Before, it had been, look, we have to worry about great power competition, countries that have a lot of sovereignty. And then suddenly, the conventional wisdom was turned on its head. It said, no, we don't have to worry about those. We actually have decent relations with most of the major centers of world power. The problems now are countries that are vacuums of power, that have a deficit of sovereignty. And when areas are, quote-unquote, ungoverned, as the Defense Department like to call them, they can become either havens for illicit activity, such as terrorism or transnational crime or proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, or they can also be areas where pandemic diseases and other sorts of dangers might flow from. So suddenly, the problem of state building and of state strength and institutional resilience became much more of a focus of American strategy. I think we're now beginning to move away from that and look a little bit more back towards power centers, partly because we've had such an emergence of major power centers, not least China, but India, Brazil, and others.
So let's get back to the intellectual origins of this book. So given this context that we've just described, you leave the government after your fellowship is over, are you left with a sense, hey, we've gone too far in the wrong direction with too many wrong assumptions, I think, so I better sort of figure this out?
Yes, I think that my sense was that a lot of the policy documents, and including, actually, in interest of full disclosure, ones that I participated in writing, I mean, we were routinely, the policy planning staff write certain lines that would find their ways into speeches by Secretary of State Colin Powell and others, basically talking about the dangers emanating from weak and failing states. And it's not to say that they don't sometimes, but it was painting with such a broad brush that I felt that it didn't provide much analytical clarity for policymakers to figure out, well, what sorts of states and what sorts of threats, and let's look a little bit more closely at this. And I had, among other things, when I was at the State Department, helped, along with many other people, set up an Office of the Coordinator of Reconstruction and Stabilization, which was trying, in the aftermath of our difficulties in Iraq and Afghanistan, was trying to think of, well, can we build up some civilian capability, both on the preventative and then on the response side of some of these fragile and failing states? But when I left, I just thought intellectually, wouldn't it be interesting to do the first comprehensive look at the degree to which these major threats that we've been focusing on—terrorism, proliferation, energy insecurity, transnational crime, and pandemic disease—are actually associated with failing states.
So, with this problem in front of you, then the problem becomes: well, what is a fragile or failing state? So what are the criteria mm-hmm. that you came up with? And what sort of history and data did you have to go through to begin to answer that question?
Sure. I mean, this was the first challenge, really, was to try to offer some greater analytical clarity and conceptual clarity on what we meant by a fragile state, what one means by a fragile state. And that's the accepted euphemism these days. It turns out that many countries around the world don't mind being called fragile states, but weak and failing is less appetizing from a diplomatic perspective. Mm-hmm. So that's become the term of art. What I did with in the beginning of this project was I worked with Susan Rice, obviously now the U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, but at the time was a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. And Susan and I have known each other since junior high school, since we both grew up in Washington, D.C. And although she's gone on to bigger and better things, she was very gracious and collaborated with me when I was at the Center for Global Development right after leaving the administration. And we decided to create something called an Index of State Weakness in the Developing World, which was an effort to measure all 141 developing and transitional countries in the world according to their institutional strength. And to answer your question explicitly, my definition of a fragile state is a state that has difficulty satisfying or delivering on the four basic functions of what the modern state should do. And those four functions are the first, providing security to its inhabitants and controlling its territory, which is the sort of Weberian conception of a state having the monopoly on the use of force. The second is a state is resilient or strong to the degree that it has accountable and effective political institutions that provide some degree of representation, voice, and accountability. The third criterion is economic, and that is, does it create an environment conducive to economic growth and private sector activity and growth that's sustainable but also relatively equitably shared? And then the final criteria is on social welfare. To what degree does the state provide certain basic social welfare goods like health and education and in addition to sanitation and access to clean water and that sort of things? Now, I want to be I have to make some admissions that historically, the concept of what states should do has evolved quite a bit over time. And, you know, in this country, we still have very vigorous debates about, for instance, whether or not the state should be providing health care. But nevertheless, these four basic categories are ones that virtually all countries, whether they're developing countries or developed countries, have broadly accepted. And so we tried to rank them. And what we did was we ranked the countries according to 20 different indicators drawn from everything from Freedom House to the World Bank to UN agencies. And we were able to come up with a spectrum of institutional strength, this countries ranked by institutional strength.
Mm-hmm. And what would your answer be to critics who say, well, this is a Western model, one that assumes progress and defines its benchmarks by what we did historically, and now even Francis Fukuyama is saying, and it took a long time
right.
to do that.
The critics have a point, and this is, as I admit in the book, based on, in a sense, an ideal type Western model of what a state is. And there are a couple of caveats that I add in the book. One of them is that not only has what the concept of the state changed over time. For instance, 100 years ago, except with the exception of maybe Bismarck or Wilhelmine Germany, there wouldn't have really been an expectation that national or social insurance would be provided for the elderly population in a country, whereas we take that for granted, at least in the United States now. The other issue is the fact that you have to admit that many countries around the world have never been effectively functioning states, in part because they are the products of the largely European colonial or imperial enterprise. And let's just say that when European diplomats were drawing very straight lines in chancelleries in Berlin and elsewhere, London and Paris, to divide up Africa, they were not necessarily paying much attention to the viability of those states. So many of the states that we see in the world have have been, to a large degree, quasi-states. They have the juridical or legal trappings of sovereignty, but they're still working on the empirical trappings of sovereignty and actually delivering. And we all, as you point out, you know, we have to remind ourselves that the United States was probably about, 85 years old when it fought one of the bloodiest wars in world history, the Civil War, before it became consolidated as a federal state. So we have to be sympathetic to the fact that other countries will take a long time. But the general sectors that I describe are ones that are broadly accepted internationally.
Mm-hmm. And it sounds like what you're looking for is benchmarks theoretically in a way that actually would filter down to the policy process. So it's a checklist in a way that I would assume you think is contributing to the thinking right. of the policymakers who might read your book.
Yes, what we tried to do was Susan and I very explicitly tried to do something that was replicable. It was totally transparent, where the indicators, you know, anybody could redo it, and you could do it year after year if you'd like to. One of the things we wanted to do was to show, and it comes out very clearly, is that some countries are sort of afflicted across the board in terms of these four sectors of state function and the 20 sub indicators. You know, there are some countries. I mean, the archetype of the failed, collapsed state, obviously, is Somalia, but others like the Democratic Republic of the Congo, which is trying to have an election as we speak and is having a lot of difficult time, fail across the board. In other cases, some countries are simply stung by one particular issue. Colombia, for instance, failed miserably when we did our index on security because it couldn't control 40% of its territory. But I also want to make a point that doing an index in and of itself is a good first cut approximation. But a point I try to make in the book is that it doesn't tell you about the trajectory of the country. So you could have, for instance, Zimbabwe under Robert Mugabe and Liberia under Ellen Johnson Sirleaf quite closely ranked together, mm-hmm. quite towards the bottom of this index. But they'd be going in very different directions because of political leadership. And one of the points that I routinely return to in the book is that it's not enough simply to talk about state capability. It's important to talk about state commitment or state will. That is, what is the will of the ruling regime to deliver for its people and also to fight some of these transnational threats? It's a theme that's woven throughout the book.
And will presumably would be shaped by culture and history and institutions, which then provide incentives for leaders to make choices.
Yes, indeed. And I think that, in addition, I try to come up with a little bit of a taxonomy of state weakness as well, beyond simply the ranking system. I note that you spoke of incentives, and I think that, unfortunately, many of the countries that would fall into the weak or critically weak categories, according to my book, are those in which the incentives have been skewed in part because they're superficially wealthy countries in the sense that they have abundant natural resources and natural resource endowments. And so you get a country like Nigeria, which has been growing quite fast for some time, and yet the vast majority of the oil wealth that Nigeria has as part of the resource curse is siphoned off to support a system of political patronage, whereas the rest of the population, you know, is immiserated at the same time. The lack of institutions and the weakness of institutions can provide sort of perverse incentives for some leaders to not do the right thing by their people.
You identify four variables that actually help us understand the future trajectory. You talk about the baseline resilience of
That's
institutions,
right.
The presence of long-term risk factors of instability, nature of the external environment, the present. Of short terms. Talk a little about that.
Sure. Yeah.
Because how do you weigh those four things?
Right. I think that, the book is not about, you know, how about the causes of state failure, but it does address, at least as part of its schema, how to think about state failure. And state failure or success is a factor, as you said, of source four basic baseline characteristics or factors. One of them is what I've just been talking about. What is the baseline resilience or institutional strength of a particular country? And that is captured, I think, quite well by the index on state weakness that forms the basis of the book. Beyond that, there are, however, underlying risk factors that can make it much more a country much more susceptible to actually deteriorating and collapsing. One of them is a major dependence on primary commodities, which are obviously susceptible to great fluctuations in price, particularly if they're elutable commodities or commodities whose revenue streams can be sort of siphoned off by a particular part of the population. Countries that are highly fractured along ethnic lines, countries that have a very, very strong population growth rate and a youth bulge, which can be volatile, particularly if you have a lot of unemployed males. There are a number of other demographic and economic factors that can play in. But then there's the outside environment. And sometimes the outside environment can be benign or helpful. It used to be said that it may no longer be true that you know, a closer a country was to the European Union, that at least it would be sort of drawn towards the European Union's orbit. These days, that may not be a great example to use. But if countries in sub-Saharan Africa, conceivably, if South Africa remains a motor of growth, could conceivably benefit from that. You know, are there alliances? Are there trade relationships that give a country like Mali, which isn't cotton exporter, does it get a chance to export its cotton? Unfortunately, the answer to the United States is no, since we have cotton tariffs. But that would be an example of an external environment. But all of that really constitutes the kindling. It determines how dry the tinder is. When countries really go into failure is when there's a triggering event or a shock from either outside or inside. And those are very difficult to predict. They can include assassinations, which is what set off or at least helped trigger the genocide in Rwanda in 1994. But they can also include just dramatic sudden spikes in food prices, for instance, that send many people into the streets.
A point that you're making throughout the book, especially in the end when you talk about recommendations, is really the importance of the profile of the particular place. And this seems to follow from what you're saying. So in a way, at one level, you're dealing with general propositions. But that's leading you to say, in effect, you really have to know this place, its history,
yes.
Its tribal makeup, whatever, before you can know how to respond to the situation.
Very much so. I think it's a plea for nuance and also for case-specific assessments. That's a no one-size-fits-all approach, which I think was one of the things that was bothering me about our sort of blanket use of the phrase weak and failing states. I think it's really important to try to get in and try to understand the specific political economy of dysfunction and fragility in each case. You know, who is benefiting? What groups are and what groups aren't? What factors are driving this? To paraphrase Tolstoy, like all unhappy families, fragile or failing states are, in a sense, unhappy in their own way. I think there are some pathologies that may run through, but when you look closer, they're all distinctive in their own way, in part because of the cultural and sometimes religious issues that you raise.
Is there a tension implicit in the relationship between a global power that, in essence, needs a strategic vision on the one hand, and on the other, the need to really know the local, to know the situation? It seems that's a hard nut to crack, because for a great power, a global power like the United States, it wants to come up with a statement that generalizes all of the particulars.
Yeah, I think that's partly what the United States, I think, has gotten itself locked into in its policy towards weak and failing states. There is always a temptation. It's beloved by academics and it's beloved by strategists, this notion of a grand strategy. And, we were either fortunate or overly simplistic, depending on your view, during the Cold War that, we had a the fact that we had a major adversary allowed us to adopt a doctrine of containment, pursue it reasonably consistently for, 44 years or 42 years. And I think that what we face now is, probably a return more towards to a more normal pattern of history where we are facing problems that are of a both sort of traditional geopolitical problems, but then also geoeconomic competition, these fragile and failing state problems, but then also increasingly issues of global and transnational threats that are not ones that we've seen so much in our history in the past. And so it just requires a little bit more of a nimble approach to foreign policy, I would say.
It's interesting because as you talk, one of the things I'm concluding is that you start writing kind of a vision for a great global power, but in the end, the ideal place for it is part of a global agenda for a multilateral organization like the UN, if it were all that it could be.
Yes, I towards the end, I do have some pointers for U.S. Foreign policy too about. First of all, how to think in terms of prioritizing amongst weak and failing states. I also talk about some institutional changes and fixes that would probably help what the United States does in terms of engaging these countries. But you're right. The reality is that the United States is making a psychological adjustment right now to still being the world's preeminent power, but one that is increasingly reliant upon the cooperation of others, other major centers of power and of influence and of resources to actually get things done. And so, in 1960, I would wager, I don't have the exact figures, but I would wager that during the time that JFK was launching the Alliance for Progress, that the United States probably was responsible for about 60% of total official foreign aid, official development assistance. And the current figure is much, much smaller than that now. And in many of these countries, we are third, maybe fourth in terms of our influence. The World Bank is there. Other big donor countries are there. And then suddenly we have a whole bunch of non-traditional donors who don't always play by the same rules, like China or India. Coming in and becoming a force. And we can't afford to simply design things made in the USA without coordinating our efforts with other donors, much less with the actual inhabitants on the ground, mm-hmm. who often have very set priorities.
Now, a piece of this book looks at the global threats that emerged, you know, with the end of the Cold War. And I want to walk you through that because you do a very interesting analysis ticking off the elements of the problem. What is important for your book is when you were in government, the argument was being made that there was a link between this problem of fragile states and these global threats. Of course, the preeminent one was terrorism after 9/11. Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little about that, because superficially, it seems to be that the link is very powerful between states, fragile states like Afghanistan, and terrorist networks like Al-Qaeda.
Yes, it is obviously. It was easily the premier issue that that led people to make this connection. It's clear that over the years, Al-Qaeda has had a presence in and made use of certain countries that definitely qualify as being fragile, including Sudan, Afghanistan, Pakistan, the borderlands in particular, Yemen, and to some degree in Somalia more recently. The closer you looked at the connection, the more you realize that that things were much more complicated than they seem. The first observation is that there are many, many weak and failing states around the world, and including many with significant Muslim majority populations or minorities. But the vast majority of them had virtually no relevance to Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda leaders primarily but even many of their foot soldiers as well come from, with a very few exceptions, including Yemen, come overwhelmingly from some of the more more advanced but often authoritarian countries within the Arab world. There was an exaggeration that that these countries were hotbeds of actual terrorist recruitment. In addition, The U.S. government was focused very strongly on areas where particularly ungoverned spaces. There was the CIA actually had a project on looking at ungoverned spaces that might be sanctuaries for terrorists and other illicit actors, and came up with sort of 50 zones around the world, et cetera. But the more you looked at that that claim, the more you realized that the notion of a safe haven in a failed or collapsed state is something of an oxymoron. And there's a great anecdote about this from the 1990s that's been captured by the Countering Terrorism or the Center for Counterterrorism at West Point. During the 1990s, Bin Laden was being hosted in Khartoum by the Sudanese government, and he wanted to send out some operatives to try to establish a beachhead in the Horn of Africa, particularly Somalia. And so he sent out his Africa Corps. But there were a number of cables that came back that, in the context of what the Westerners were experiencing and the UN was experiencing in Somalia, were actually sort of funny in retrospect, because the cables went along something like this. Osama, we have to tell you, these people are impossible. They're incredibly clannish. Yeah. The logistics are terrible. There's no operational security. Mm-hmm. We can't transfer money. And what this place really needs is an Islamic-led state-building project to sort of get it up to snuff so that we can actually operate here. So it suggested that, you know, there's a lot more to it than just an ungoverned zone. One thing that it suggested was that and when I looked at it a little bit more, Al-Qaeda has had some success when, for instance, when it was under the Taliban, the cooperation with the Taliban, when there actually has been a state that is sponsoring it or to some degree looking the other way. You know, we tend to make this distinction between state sponsors of terrorism and those countries that are, you know, fighting terrorism tooth and nail. But I think our experience with Pakistan, for instance, over the last, say, 10 years, despite repeated invocations of Pakistan as our loyal ally in the global war on terrorism, I think what we've seen is that the actual policy is often a murky middle ground where one part of the government is doing something and the other part is doing something quite different. And in the case of Pakistan, obviously, the state support for jihadi groups has to do with the fact that it still is engaged in a major struggle with India over Kashmir and is worried about its rivalry with India. In addition to this issue of state sponsorship, there's another issue that determines whether or not a fragile state could become hospitable to an al-Qaeda-like organization. And that has to do with what is the actual receptivity on the part of local populations. Mm-hmm. In the case of the Pashtun Belt, which crosses both sides of the Durand Line in Afghanistan and Pakistan, one of the reasons why al-Qaeda found so much of a haven there was because the people there were very, very receptive to its sort of firebrand version of Islam, but also have the code of Pashtunwali, which includes, among other things, being receptive to showing hospitality to strangers. Similar dynamics played out in some of the tribal regions of Yemen, where you see this not happening is in the Sahel region of Africa, and in part because there's a lot of influence there of a more moderate Sufi version of Islam. So it's just not simple equation to say weak and failing states equal terrorism. There's a lot of diversity and other dynamics.
And you're suggesting that the focus on the state and supporting the state may be counterproductive in a way if the goal is to address the problem, which seems to be the case with our relationship with Pakistan.
Yes.
Where, over the years we gave, after 9/11, maybe $10 billion in aid.
And I think there's a number of things going on there. I think partly we never really asked enough of the Pakistanis. I think we were unrealistic about what they were prepared to give us. But I think that, yes, it's another variable is that we often worked through the central government and did not insist that the things that they were actually spending money on were those things that might help to either bring improvements into the federally administered tribal areas or might help to wean some of elements off extremism. And instead, the Pakistani government spent many of those things on military equipment that would be much more suited to fighting the Indians. I think that in addition, and slowly the U.S. began to figure this out in certain areas, the need to work at a sub-state level with local actors. Rather than simply trying to bring the state in, because the state was often mistrusted, but trying to work with local actors to try to decrease the level of hospitality that al-Qaeda enjoyed.
We don't have time, and I recommend your book because you actually go through a number of what were perceived as the security threats in this post-Cold War world, proliferation, cross-border criminal activity, energy insecurity, major infectious disease, and the push of policy, as you pointed out, was to say all of these were tied to the existence of fragile states.
Sure.
If we do a survey of all of those, your basic conclusion is that the connection is often very tenuous.
Very much so. I'll just touch on a couple of those very briefly. The transnational crime, for instance, is an interesting one. The book covers six different aspects of transnational crime, and it concludes that in certain aspects of transnational crime, particularly production of illicit narcotics, opium, which is the lion's share, probably 93%, is coming out of Afghanistan, or coca, where the plurality is coming from Colombia, although Peru's again giving it a run for its money. In those situations, clearly there is a connection between the drug production and state weakness. When it comes to drug trafficking, the situation is a little bit different. There are countries like Guinea Guinea-Bissau on the coast of West Africa that, in a sense, has become, you know, a fully funded, you know, enterprise of Colombian drug cartels, sending coca up through Western Africa into Europe. But you know, look at Mexico, for instance, which is by no means a failed state, although some people have said that it was on the verge of becoming so. It's actually institutionally reasonably resilient, but it's facing a massive, massive drug war. And the reason, of course, is that we have an insatiable appetite for drugs that are transiting Mexico. We've also sent a lot of small arms down south. But Mexico is one of those countries, like South Africa as well, which is also an epicenter of major crime, which has one foot in the developed world and one foot in the developing world, has high, high levels of corruption, but functions reasonably well and is integrated into the global economy. And that's one of the lessons that comes out in this book. It comes out in the book when I talk about infectious diseases as well. Those countries that are in theory, you would think that countries that are at the that don't have rudimentary health and epidemiological surveillance systems, et cetera, would be the weak underbelly of global public health. Well, it turns out, despite the fact that we're interested or concerned about really horrific diseases like Ebola virus, that many of those types of diseases actually originate in countries that are just not connected to the rest of the global economy. And although my boss, Richard Haass, likes to say that the world isn't Vegas. What happens there doesn't stay there. What my book suggests is actually a lot of times what happens there does stay there. And when you look at the big global health threats like a potential mutation that could cause avian influenza to be really, really bad or swine flu, et cetera, those have very, very little to do with some of these the weakest states in the world, in part because they're just not connected to the global economy.
Mm-hmm. Now when you move on to trying to give a grade to America's response to the problem of fragile states and the interaction, you don't give a high mark to the U.S. No. And what has been the problem there? Is it the fragmentation of the government, the over militarization of our policy, or what?
Yeah, it's been a number of things. Certainly, I think over the last 10 years, you have seen an over-militarization of many aspects of U.S. foreign and even foreign and development policy. I think by 2006, the Department of Defense was responsible for 22% of U.S. official development assistance. Now, a lot of that was happening in Iraq and Afghanistan, but the U.S. military was partly because the civilian agencies couldn't get the money from Congress to actually engage fragile states. So the DOD, the Pentagon, was increasingly getting resources and using its resources to try to engage in so-called permissive environments, but places where there was a fear that a country might be headed to state failure. And it started using, for instance, its regional combatant commands as platforms to try to organize interagency cooperation to try to head off state collapse. Now, I'm all for the Pentagon thinking conflict prevention is a great thing. But whether or not U.S. approaches should have a military uniform on them is quite another question. So the militarization was one issue, and there's been efforts by Secretary of State Clinton and others to try, and the President Obama, to try to restore some balance in resources. But it's an uphill struggle in Congress. Other issues are that the sort of aid that we actually provide fragile states is not often tailored to their circumstances. Sometimes we act as if it's business as usual, as if this is a normal aid environment. But often you're dealing with corrupt governments. You have to probably try to bypass some of those governments. In other cases, what we do is we create sort of a parallel public sector that sort of leeches talent out of the government, partly because there are differential wage scales. So what you find in a country like Haiti, for instance, is that when the international community descends on the place, a lot of the folks who would be, junior ministers or sort of the third tier down figure out, well, it's a lot more lucrative to be, a driver or a translator for these foreigners who are coming mm-hmm. through than to actually stay and build capacity within the ministries. So there's an over-reliance on external contractors, an over-reliance on sending money through the capitals as opposed to going out to the localities. We've really not learned a lot of the lessons of the past.
As you look at this set of problems which you've analyzed so effectively, what are your thoughts about America's present political environment in which the government seems to be stalemated? I'm talking now here about the United States.
Indeed.
And judging from the Republican debates,
sure.
Essentially they want zero-based budgeting for all these endeavors. So there's a real withdrawal syndrome.
Yes.
In the air, with the exception of the military,
right,
where
exactly.
there's an argument that they shouldn't be cut at all.
That's right. That's right. It's a it's extremely difficult environment. Already you've seen Congress attempting to cut back on some of the very much needed increases to keep steady state budgets of the State Department and USAID, and particularly USAID, which was just beginning to come out of this couple of decades of real ineffectual budgeting and ineffectual staffing, and try to restore some of the credibility. It used to be a marquee aid agency around the world, and it just was reduced to a contracting shop after a while. The environment on Capitol Hill is brutal when it comes to, particularly in the Republican-controlled House, when it comes to funding the United Nations. And UN peacekeeping, which is something I talk about quite a bit in the book, is something that is extremely cost effective. For every 25 cents we spend, we get a dollar of effort from the international community. And it's helped us keep a lid on some of the most volatile places in the world where we don't want to put our own soldiers' boots on the ground. So the fact that there's a retrenchment from the United Nations, I think, is quite worrisome. The fact that there's a retrenchment from foreign aid, and in the debates you've had many leading candidates suggest that, we should get rid of all of it or make major cutbacks. I think, that's a red meat line to the Republican Party base, and also at a time when, the United States is having such difficulties at home. I'm sympathetic with the notion of, well, we have to conserve everywhere, and maybe we should do a little nation building at home. I think that that's true, but I think that. It's also based on an extremely misleading a misperception, extreme misperception of the amount that we actually spent on foreign assistance and on. And I don't understand why the Osprey or is it the F-22 Raptor gets a pass for such huge expenditure. When investments in institutions and in human development around the world in some of the world's poorest places, that's ripe for cutting. It doesn't make much sense to me on the cost-benefit analysis.
You have specific proposals about the U.S., and my sense is that a big thing is emphasizing intelligence and prevention in a
yes.
way. In other words, using the criteria and trajectories that you define to think about places that you might want to put aid or be thinking about how a situation is unraveling. Talk a little about that, and are we capable of that?
Yes. As to whether or not we're capable, I have some skepticism, having been in the government and realizing, my frustration and something I realized when I served in the government, I was only in for 2.5 years, was just the degree to which policymakers are subject to the tyranny of the inbox. When you talk to, that is, whatever is coming over the transom that day is what you're dealing with. And this was true even in a place like the policy planning staff, which is supposed to be interested in longer range theory. Even George Kennan, when he was setting up the policy planning staff, said that, the dilemma is really how do you keep from being sucked in simply into the events of the day and providing advice in that regard. When we would go, when we were thinking about setting up this post-conflict reconstruction office at the State Department, we insisted that one of its mandates would be conflict prevention, and should be conflict prevention. And when we would talk about this with the regional bureaus of the State Department, their attitude was conflict prevention. We got that covered. That's what we do every. That's what diplomacy is. We're preventing conflict every day in our diplomatic efforts. The reality is that. Nobody really is doing something to scan the horizon more long term, with the exception sometimes of the intelligence agencies. And so what we tried to do, one of the things that we promoted was something called an interagency conflict assessment framework, which was something that a number of different agencies of the U.S. government, Defense Department, USAID, State Department, the intelligence agencies, et cetera, would have a common perception or common picture of what actually was the trajectory of a particular country. And the idea was if you could get upstream, as they say, as much as possible, there might be things that you could do, your government, the United States, along with other friendly governments and international institutions to try to head something off on the, you know, the old adage that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. One difficulty with that is that diplomatically, it can be very sensitive to do contingency planning for something that has not occurred yet, because you don't want to. You can risk a self-fulfilling prophecy if you start. If a country finds out that you're planning for its potential failure, you know, you can sort of accelerate that process. The other is that it's very, very hard to get money from Congress to do even very modest contingency planning along these, and then to have quick resources or flexible resources to go in very quickly if, in terms of an aid intervention, if it were needed.
What is your sense of the ideal use of your book, and by whom? Because what one has a sense of is you've really laid out an important problem. You've shown us, you know, all of the elements of the problem at a time when the U.S. ability to do anything about this problem set is kind of decreasing. So do you see a pivot of some sort where, you know, that in other words, a book you may have written for an American policy audience and the general public. And for the general public, it works because it really will help them understand what the policymakers are doing. But the policymakers might not act on it. So is there a pivot here? In other words, what is the politics of making your book a manual, right, in a way, for dealing with a set of problems that are very important?
Yeah, I would say that the primary message, probably for the Washington policy community at least, and that would be, and also international policymakers too, members of international institutions and foreign governments, who I think also would be interested in this, is to really say, let's take a collective deep breath, and not paint with such a broad brush. Let's try to engage. I think I'm mixing a lot of metaphors here, but let's try to engage in a lot of triage and priority setting. And from the perspective of the United States, particularly in an age of diminished resources, increasing fiscal constraints, we really have to think. If we're thinking about security problems, we need to think about three tiers of problems. The first are genuine security problems that might be emanating from these states, and we really have to come up with. Think of it as a consequences matrix. If this country goes to hell in a handbasket, what conceivably could happen? And that's what I try to do in the book. That could harm U.S. citizens and perhaps the lives of some of our allies as well. That's the first tier. The second tier are issues that don't necessarily affect our security, but really affect our not just our moral stature, but our moral sentiments. And those are grave humanitarian and human rights disasters and mass atrocities, which might require us to intervene under the newly established doctrine of the responsibility to protect, which all UN member states endorsed in 2005. And that's an important set of, because we don't want to have another Rwanda occur again. And then the third tier are really more sort of developmental issues. The fact that countries are sort of trundling along and we can use our, they don't necessarily call for more resources, but we can use our resources more effectively to try to get at the root causes of weak institutions in those countries. So that's what I would say. I think from the perspective of, I also hope it'll be used by students quite a bit, because I actually think that it's, you know, the topics are reasonably, you know, sexy in some ways, because, you know, everything from pandemics to weapons of mass destruction, et cetera. I think it's probably a useful text for survey courses, or either a course on weak states or a course on transnational threats.
What about the general public? If they were to read mm-hmm. this book, what would you like them to get out of it?
I think that I'd like them, as well as policymakers, to get out of it that many of the threats that are conventionally associated with weak and failing states are not necessarily emanating from those countries, but tend to actually emanate or be facilitated in countries that are actually ranked slightly higher up on the scale. So whether you look at energy insecurity, where I'd be much more concerned with the situation in Venezuela, for instance, than with the situation in Angola or even Nigeria. Similarly, with infectious disease, you know, it's interesting that it's not the sort of scary things that you know, see in movies like Contagion, etc., or Outbreak, where it tends to be scary unknown diseases emanating from some of the poorest, most remote corners of the world. It's really the acute, rapid onset pandemic influenzas, and in many cases, those are coming from places like China, frankly, or from reasonably developed countries within Southeast Asia, for a variety of ecological and other reasons. So I think just to get a better sense of where. Of how to think about threats in this day and age, and to try to get through and away from just to broad generalizations. I think the general reader will find that it's sort of fun, because it includes, in addition to a bunch of data, it also includes a number of little sort of country mini case studies, from the terrorist threat from Yemen to energy insecurity in the Niger Delta to the exploits or depredations of pirates off the coast of Somalia. So it has a lot of sort of the texture of what's in the news, and tries to wrap it all together into a coherent story.
Well, on that note, Stuart, let me show the book one more time. And thank you very much for taking the time to be on our program.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you so much, Eric.
And thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.